Science can't explain everything. Just because you can't see me doesn't mean I'm not here.
Thank you for joining me, everyone, and welcome to Paranormal Encounters podcast series. My name is Dr. Kelly Renee Schutz. I am the host and the producer of this show. Sit back, grab yourself some popcorn, and let's get started.
Be careful what you wish for.
Good evening, everyone. Yes, as they say, let's get started. In just a moment, we are going to meet Amanda Wooner. So please sit back and enjoy.
Whether you're listening at home, at work, or anywhere, thanks for making Para-X part of your day. Your source for everything paranormal, Para-X.
Well, hello, Amanda, and welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Oh, I love having you on. You are my bright side of my day today. So after this, it's washing dishes. Now imagine which one I would rather do, right? Yeah.
Fair enough. I'll take it.
All right. So I think what we're going to start this show out tonight, Amanda is a writer, and I'd like to somehow connect her writing abilities with her experiences. And I find that to be, some of your books are really, really great, as everyone has seen in the introduction. And I want to kind of discuss them in a bit here. But before we get to that point, let's start out a little bit with, have you had a lot of any type of paranormal experiences in your life? And can you go back as far as you can remember and share with us a story or two?
Sure. So my very first encounter with the paranormal, I think, is very similar to a lot of other paranormal investigators. I was about 7 years old where I had my first encounter in my house. I was just lying in bed, and when I looked out into the hallway, I saw an elderly woman in a bathrobe with crazy bedhead and slippers, and she was walking through the hallway, and she stopped, and she turned and stared at me before continuing on into what is our linen closet. Yep. And I'd like to think I was brave, but I screamed for my mommy immediately, and she actually ran through the old woman, so she didn't see her at all. And that was the only time I ever saw this old woman. I don't feel like I grew up in a haunted house in any way, shape, or form. But I know I saw her. And I found out years later that the previous owner had been an elderly woman, and that she had passed away in the house. Oh. So the pieces kind of started coming together over the years. But that was really kind of the seed that was planted in my mind of, what the heck was that? Is there some sort of explanation? I just saw a ghost. And there wasn't a lot of children's books at the time about unexplained phenomena. So I tried to trudge through adult books, and it just went way over my head, which is kind of the reason why I work some children's books into my writing, just to try to introduce kids to this stuff, because they're experiencing it just as much as adults are. And the adults seek this stuff out. The kids usually don't. So if they can be as prepared as possible, that would be nice.
Let me jump in. One question here, Amanda. I want to go back quickly to this older woman. Now, a lot of people ask me, and people see their apparitions in various forms. Okay. So would you say that she was fairly full bodied? Let's start with that.
Completely. She looked 100% like a real person. I didn't see through her or anything. It wasn't a typical ghost. It was literally an old woman standing in my hallway.
And how, now, you know, when we're young, the age of 20 looks like an old person, you know, so yeah. it's in the eyes of a child. So you're about 7.
Yeah.
And so you're pretty, what I would say would be pretty fairly conscious human being at this point. In other words, you can remember things are being put together pretty well. So when you saw her and she looked at you, would you say that she had an older face, or do you think she represented herself to you in a younger kind of look?
I mean, she definitely looked like a grandma to me. She didn't look like my grandmother's, but the same generation of sorts. So, and I don't know if that would have been like how she chose to represent herself, so she wouldn't terrify me, even though she still did.
Yeah.
But then to find out years later that, you know, she was an elderly woman, I believe she was in her 80s when she passed away in the house. It all kind of started to make sense afterwards. But she was definitely an old lady. I'm not even going to say she was older. She was an old lady, wrinkle, crazy, almost like permed hair, which is funny. Yeah. My grandmother did have a horrible permed head of hair.
Yeah.
So she was definitely an old woman, but very, very physical. You know, I could not see through her across the hall. For a split second, I thought someone had broken into the house.
Yeah.
But then quickly realized that wasn't the case.
How long do you think you actually visualized her for and seen her for? 3-5 seconds?
If that. I mean, it was very, very, it was quick.
Yeah.
Before I screamed for my mom and she came running in. And then, you know, by then the woman had kind of passed into the closet and my mom had run right through her. So only a few seconds.
Now that's interesting that your mother ran through her. Different, or have you ever, did you tell her, mom, you just ran right through her?
So she very quickly was like, it's all in your head. You had a bad dream. Your eyes were playing tricks on you. And I, you know, had every argument against her and stuff. At the time, we were a very, very conservative Christian family. And ghosts aren't real.
Right.
You know, and, you know, you go to heaven or you go to hell when you die. That's it. Nothing sticks around. So right. I think that was her mentality of like, well, you didn't see something because they don't exist. It's all in your head.
Right.
Now that we're removed from that environment and that mindset, and she's very much more open to the idea of a spirit world and ghosts and more than just what we learned in Sunday school.
Yeah.
I'd be interested. I would love to be able to go back with like our experiences now to experience that moment to see, did you feel something? Was there a sensation? Did you see something and you didn't admit it because you didn't want to terrify your 7-year-old? So I don't know. And at the time she was convincing me, and I don't know if she tried to convince herself that nothing had happened. But unfortunately with the circumstances of our belief system at the time, it was very limiting and made me question myself a little bit. But then I just went down the rabbit hole. There was no stopping me, and they eventually followed.
You've got my curiosity up. Can I just give me the state? What state did you live in at the time?
New York.
Okay, New York. Okay. Were you in an apartment in New York, or were you in an older house up in upstate New York? What was the age of the home that you lived in?
So we were in Western New York, in Buffalo, New York, and the house is built in the early 1920s.
Okay.
So I assume she was the first owner. That's just what I'm assuming. But we know it was at least built in like 1922, 1923, around there.
Yep. And I know you probably know this, obviously, like everyone, that you don't have to have an older house to be to have a haunted house. So yeah. Now you had this experience. Did you only experience that one time?
Yes. Yeah, so I only ever saw her once. After our family pet passed away, my parents saw her still. They would feel her. She was a cat. They would feel her jumping up on the bed. I felt it for years. And I was like, well, I'm not going to tell them. They're not going to believe me.
Yeah.
Find out years later, my dad's like, oh yeah, like we felt the cat for years after she died. And I was like, why weren't you talking about this? So, I mean, Was the house haunted? I don't necessarily think so, but there was definitely some interesting things happening that continued to pique my interest and continued to convince me that there is something going on here. We just can't see it. We don't fully understand it. Let's keep researching. Mm-hmm. But I only saw the old lady one time, and I'm kind of okay about that because it was a little jarring.
Yeah, sometimes once is enough. Let's talk just a little bit about, because you just brought up a good point here, and I haven't talked a lot about our animals and their existence after they pass away on my shows. I have written about that, and I've had experiences with that as well. My husband, who is kind of he's a diehard Catholic, he had an experience, and he cannot deny that, although he would like to just try to pretend like it never happened. Yeah. But I have found that family pets, especially if they do pass away, they do stick around for a while. Like dogs, I think, might stick around until the point that they know that their owner is going to be okay without them. And cats, definitely, apparently in my one house, the cat that passed away in that house had passed away 14 years prior to are taking over, you know, buying and purchasing that home. I've had experiences with what felt like a dog try to jump, you know how they jump on the side of the bed, yeah. They try to pull the covers or everything kind of down a little bit. I have had that experience. And then I've also had them chase around my ankles, where it kind of feels like a little whirlwind. And it's just like, what is going on around my ankles right now? And so I'm going to put this on you for the moment here. So when your family pet passed away, how long after that did you start having experiences?
It wasn't instantaneous. At least I didn't realize it was instantaneous. This was a cat that I had my entire life. So I was the one in the household that was absolutely devastated. But probably a month or so after she had passed, I distinctly remember the sensation of her jumping up on the bed and needing the blanket.
Yeah.
And I actually laid there for a second, like, what in the world? Like, I'm gonna look at my feet and see a cat there. And obviously I did, and there was nothing there. That was very strange. We started hearing her, like her little paws running down the stairs. So it was interesting. It wasn't just my bedroom. It was my room. It was my parents' room. It was my brother's room. It was the stairs. So it was really interesting that it was all throughout the house. And it was several years, even after the fact, where, you know, I'm a teenager at this point, I've gotten over the death of the cat. But every so often I would just feel that sensation again of her jumping up on the bed and walking in a circle and like kind of just snuggling up. And finally I was just like, all right, hi, Sushi. Like, nice to see you, I guess. And it was nice. Eventually we got another cat years later. And then obviously if I hear cat sounds, I'm going to assume it's the actual cat, not a ghost cat. But by the time we got the new cat, you know, the phenomena or whatever stopped. We were able to kind of move on. We got a new cat, and it was kind of that new chapter in all of our lives with a new pet in the house. And so it could have just been the sort of thing where she knew she needed to ease, at least myself, you know, away from Sushi and towards the new cat eventually. So yeah, I liked that.
It's kind of interesting because I have, when I grew up, oh my gosh, we probably had about 10 different dogs in the country, you know, 10 dogs that we had owned. They all passed away naturally in their own time. And yes, there were a couple of times with a couple of them that you could kind of tell that they were still hanging around. But that's what I was bringing up before. You know, it's very true that, you know, and it's unfortunate, but, you know, once they feel like you can live without them or whatever, then they probably, yes, as you say, make way for the new visitor, the new cat or dog that comes in and then tries to continue on, you know, loving your life, that kind of thing. Yeah. So my next question to you would go into just in general, your abilities. Many people who have abilities do seem to be like a beacon, and they seem to attract a lot of everything, you know, to their life. Now I'm still curious about what life was like for you, or if you were very distracted at a very young age, as we all were. You go to school, you're distracted. And so the last thing you really want to think about is some kind of a haunted experience that you just had. So you were seven, and then a period of time went by. What would you say would be the next age that you could not deny that you probably had another experience? And what was that?
So the next big thing for me that was kind of, again, one of those milestones for me, I was always interested in this stuff, reading books, watching documentaries, would probably be when I was 14. So double the lifespan now. And I was in Gettysburg for the first time. Mm. And we did a ghost tour, as one does when they're in Gettysburg. Yeah. And it was my first time doing anything like this. My brother was still fairly young. So he was petrified the whole time. But I just remember at one point our guide pulled out a thing of dowsing rods and he allowed people to play with them and stuff. And I'm very hit or miss when it comes to dowsing rods, any yeah. sort of equipment that someone has to hold or manipulate. I'm kind of like, I don't know. Yeah. But I, you know, held on to them because I was like, all right, when in Rome, you know, this is what we do. Yeah. And I just remember holding them and it, you know, they're doing their weird little thing. Yeah, yeah. And then all of a sudden they stopped and it felt like someone grabbed the other end of them. Like there was a pressure to it.
Yeah.
And I was freaked out a little bit at 14. And then someone snapped a photograph with a flash and several people in the group said they saw a shadow standing in front of me.
Oh my.
I didn't appreciate that. So I handed them right back to the man. And I actually didn't use dowsing rods again until like last year.
Yeah.
So it's been a while, a long time. Yeah. You know, and I use them on public events for people to try them out and stuff. And I've never experienced or witnessed anything like that ever again. And I don't know if it was anything or if it was all just, I'm in Gettysburg on a ghost tour using ghost hunting equipment. And it was just almost too much for my mind to handle. So I freaked myself out. That very well could be. But that was another seed that was planted and kind of put me on the path. Mm-hmm. That I was like, I really want to start exploring this more. And, you know, I took my tape recorder to date myself. It's a tape recorder, not a digital recorder.
Yeah, I know. And
I'm so old now, but I started using them again because they work great. Yeah. But, you know, started doing little EVP sessions at the park at the end of my street and taking pictures and thinking, oh, I got an orb and things like that. Mm-hmm. So, and I didn't really start taking it. I mean, I always took it seriously. I was always very respectful, but really started researching it after my brother passed away in 2015. Oh. And that was the kick in the behind I really needed to kind of stop seeing it as entertainment and a fun time, but actually look into what the heck is going on. Yeah. So that was definitely the turning point for me, for sure.
Interesting. Well, I'm just trying to think, you know, back in that, I know that when I was around age 14, I was on my grandparents' property out in a rural area, and they had built a really fabulous house of their time and all this sort of thing, but it gave me a creepy vibe. And there was just something on their property that made me want to see a ghost on this property. Well, my wish would come true, actually, probably 20, 25 years later, when I photographed a very clear image in their screened window. This is after both grandparents had deceased, and picked up the image of my great-grandfather and my great-aunt, yeah. who was actually 10 years old when she passed away, 6 years old in her yeah. in showing herself, but she had passed away 2 miles down the road. So that led into a whole discussion and a new thing for me about how far away do you have to live in order to haunt a house? Mm-hmm. Do you exist in this house? I presume that the older woman that you saw in your house was probably fairly existent to that house, you know, and she may have died of natural causes or she may have died of other things, but sometimes they're just not willing to let go of something that they're so attached to, or there's some memory there that they just yeah. don't want to leave. So let's go now into, judging from your biography, you're quite a writer and you've done a number of different types of books. And I kind of wanted to go over some of them a little bit because they all have kind of a life of their own. And so we were just talking just before the show, I just want you to briefly talk about, and we may jump around a little bit. I may go back to another question, but I want to start with the book, that your very first book, the one that you wrote an atlas about New York?
Yes. So the very first book was A Haunted Atlas of Western New York. Very self-explanatory. And when I was trying to think of what I wanted to write, I knew I wanted to publish a book. I figured I don't really have any money to travel anywhere. So why not write about what you're familiar with? I was very familiar with local history and local folklore. I'm very interested in it. Interesting side note, my great, great, great uncle was Leon Czolgosz, who assassinated President McKinley.
Oh, wow.
So there's that connection, that like the darker side of the local history.
Yeah.
But I was like, let's write what I know. And that's what I did. I spent about a year working on it, just researching legends and lore and haunted locations. I traveled to every single location just to make sure it actually existed. Yeah. And photographed them, offered coordinates, and I created walking tours and driving tours, a spooky bucket list.
It was
my husband's idea. It's everyone's favorite part of the book. And I get so bitter that I didn't think of it and that he had thought of it. But It had a great reception locally. It's in several of the metaphysical and ghost hunting shops we have here. It's in Barnes and Noble, apparently, which I did not realize until someone sent me a photo of it, which was really cool. But it's gotten a great reception. People really like it. And I've always told people, you know, break the binding, take notes, take this on adventures with you. That's the whole point of it. You know, after my brother had passed away, I realized that a lot of haunted locations are really difficult to access for your average everyday person looking for answers. So my hope with the Haunted Atlas is that, you know, many of these places in the Atlas are open to the public. Some of them are parks or roads that you don't even have to pay to gain access to. And my hope is that people who might have questions about the afterlife or what comes next can go to these locations and experience the paranormal for themselves so that they can come to their own conclusions about the questions that they have. Because my journey is different from other people's journey. So I can't tell you what to think or what to believe. You have to go and experience that yourself. So my hope with the Haunted Atlas was to kind of give them a guide map and be go on your journey, go find your answers, and let this kind of guide you so you don't get too lost on the way.
So I have a question regarding that. I've written several books of just my own experiences that I've encountered wherever I am. Here I am, and this is what I've encountered. Mm-hmm. But I am, for those out there who like to write or, delve into that, I have not, when I have an experience, and maybe I'm guilty of this a little bit, but I'm going to bring something up and I'm going to ask you your twist on this because you've got that published. So I was just recently out in Baltimore and I was telling this story on one of my shows. There's a number of owners of some of these haunted buildings, especially, that are very defensive and protective over the fact that it's not haunted. This just has history. Don't you call my place a haunted place. I don't want to have that reputation. Well, a lot of times people are so on the fence regarding whether they want to be known as a haunted location or whether something historical, right? So when you were writing your book, I guess I should ask you this since you've got it published and everything. In some of the cases, did you run into that? Did you run into people saying, don't put me in your book? Or did you just say, I had this experience here, so I'm going to write about it? Or what did you do? How did you approach that?
So what I did, I mean, a lot of these places are public property. So with those, you didn't have to worry about it. You know, there's legends and lore surrounding this. There's urban legends. This is just what I'm sharing this information. There were a handful of locations, about two or three altogether, which out of 130, that's not too bad.
Pretty good.
It's really good that they were like, you know, we're not interested in this. We don't want to perpetuate this. One location, we had an interesting conversation where they said, by sharing these ghost stories, you're perpetuating the stigma of mental illness because it was a former mental hospital.
Oh.
And it got me thinking. I was like, does this do that? And I really started thinking about it. And I thought, you know, I think it has everything to do with your intention. You know, if you are setting up a haunted attraction inside a former insane asylum where there's the stereotypical person in a straitjacket muttering to themselves in the corner, yes, that does perpetuate this stigma and these lies, you know, especially when so many people who were in these institutions were there against their will, or they had ailments that are perfectly normal nowadays. You know, so it did get me thinking, and it did make me kind of stop and take note, and it just put it on my radar that that is something to think about with certain locations. So yes, there were a handful of locations that didn't want to share their haunted history or be included in the book, which is fine. It's your business. I personally feel like if a location is haunted, it will gravitate more people to you as opposed to turning people away. I don't think people would be like, well, that restaurant's haunted, we shouldn't eat there. But if you say, hey, we're haunted, you might bring in some new people that might not check you out otherwise. So to me, it's not a business decision that I would do, but I don't own the location. So it is what it is.
Yeah, you bring up, well, but you do bring up a couple good points here. The first point that I want to address, and a lot of people probably are aware of this, you know, when you're talking mental hospital institutions, or just even places that used to be a sanatorium or a place where people were trying to get better. Yeah, I know it's difficult to talk about the fact that these have a very unusual and high energy and frequency to a lot of these places that have etched themselves into time, and they're still haunted and they're still having issues in some of these places of whatever is hanging around there. Very, very true. I mean, that after all, the educational piece about all of this in that regards is that even if the person has mental illness, it's not that mental illness that you're trying to focus on here. You're focusing on the energy that still exists over and beyond the fact of they have something a little bit more intense about them, or we all do, probably. It's just all a matter of whatever's going on out in the environment, but that somehow some of these stick around. So on that note, yeah, I suppose some of them don't want to participate. Yes, I've run into that too, where people want to be known as history. They don't want to be known as haunted. And so that's always, and I'm glad that you wrote a book about this. And yes, there are some of them want to be known as being haunted. But then what do you do? Do you stand by their stories? Do you try to go in and experience something yourself? Because as you and I probably both know, you know, you just can't walk into a place and go, all right, spook me out now, yeah. You know, haunt me. Usually, and that's going to be my next question for you right now here, because I'm a beacon. So wherever I go, I don't have to even use much equipment anymore. I can tell when there's something around me or something near me or whatever. So let's put this back on you for a second. So here you are, and you're going to some of these places, of course, to create a wonderful book and a wonderful guide for people who like to do this, right? Okay, so would you consider yourself, any child that sees something at the age of 7 or below that, or around age 12 or 14, you know, you have to ask yourself, what has sparked all of this? Do you find yourself to be relatively sensitive, empath, clairaudient, clairsentient? What would you consider yourself to be?
I always joke saying, because people ask me that all the time, are you sensitive? Are you a psychic? And I always joke saying that I think I'm as sensitive as a rock, that I'm not sensitive at all. I don't think that I pick up on things. But I've been told that I'm wrong, that people do argue with me about that. Since my brother has passed away, and he passed away in 2015, so it's been 7 years now. Yeah. I have heard things on a fairly regular basis that I can't explain. It's usually his voice. Doesn't matter where I am. My parents' house, I should say, I've heard him. A local theater that I've had dozens of experiences over the years. Heard him there. I've seen him there. When I was teaching in Russia, I heard his voice there, and I know my brother's voice. So I would say after my brother passed away, that I think something opened up in a way. But aside from that, no, I'm so boring when it comes to those sorts of things. I'm open to the idea of it. And again, I've been told that I'm wrong. But as of right now, I'm as sensitive as a rock that hears things every so often.
That's interesting. So when he talks to you, what people are probably wondering, what does he say to you?
A lot of times he just says my name, calls out my name. And just that in and of itself is enough to, I've heard I'm fine as well, which again, it's like, that's exactly what I want to hear. Thank you. So aside from that, it's never a long conversation or anything. Usually I feel like it's just his way of being like, I'm nearby. Don't worry about it. And I always say, cause you know, I think people always look for signs after someone passes away. Yeah. And I think anything can be a sign if, you know, if it means something to you. You know, for my family, it's acorns. That's what means something for us. Mm-hmm. And I always say, like, whether or not something is a sign actually from a deceased loved one,
right?
If you see something that makes you think of them in that moment, because you're thinking of them, they're with you. So yeah, it is a sign. Whether or not they physically placed it in front of you to, you know, make you realize that they're nearby, or if it just happened to be a beautiful coincidence, either way, you're stopping and you're putting some energy into them and you're thinking about them. And in that moment, they are right next to you. Yeah, I don't know why I said that. I was rambling at some point, but.
No, actually you bring up some good points. For a moment here, I was just starting to tingle. Do you have anything of your brother's? You don't have to show it. I'm just asking. Do you have anything of your brother's near you right now?
A lot of things, actually.
Yeah, because I'm lighting up like a Christmas tree here. So if I turn green, just or purple or
we're
red.
Fine.
If I start to blink, would you let me know?
Yeah.
Because right now I am sensing that I was just going to say, I just feel like there's something near you or by you that is of your brother's, because when you started talking about him, okay, I'm tingling again, but all over the place. So I might have to grab a sweater in just 2 seconds, but anyway, but that brings up a good point though, Amanda, because I talk to a lot of people, including family members and people who have had signs, things that have floated from their ceiling when they don't have a bird in the house or anything, and a little feather comes flying, you know, not flying, but floating down. And it's like, where did this come from? And, you know, I've had my sister, you know, contact me in a panic once because a pheasant feather that is very well connected to my dad showed up right at the door of her car when she went shopping, and there was no way. Yeah, there's just things all over the place. Now, I found a quarter the other day, and I thought the only thing that went through my head was, thank you, inflation. Yeah, thank you very much. I needed for the gas bill, actually, and the groceries. But, you know, yeah, so people can actually place certainly anything onto this stuff that they feel brings them comfort and or something that makes them feel a little bit better. Okay, so now that very good book though on New York. I love stuff like that. I think that it's fun. We're in a period of time right now, especially where people are getting more used to people talking about the paranormal, but not a certain percentage. I mean, there's still their share of skeptics out there, but they haven't ever had something that they can call noteworthy. So now where you're, I assume you're going into college, right? So we're distracted and doing other things. What was your next book that you wrote after that one?
Oh gosh, I'm trying to think back. So the next one would have been my children's book, the Cryptid ABC book, which was my attempt at doing the ABCs yeah. with cryptids. So, you know, C is for Chupacabra and M is for Mothman, things like that.
Cool.
So that was a really fun, kind of a quick book to put together. I was like, I like children's books. They went really quick. Yeah. And then the one directly after that was America's Haunted Breweries, Distilleries, and Wineries.
Let's talk about that one.
Yes, yeah. That's a fun one. Yeah, everyone's favorite.
All right, now everybody is going to the refrigerator and grabbing themselves something to drink. I know. So. Talk a little, just a little bit about that one for a moment, because I think that that one's fun too. Go ahead.
Yeah. So I actually wrote that in the middle of lockdown for COVID. I was pregnant at the time. So apparently I'm a glutton for punishment writing about liquid libations. But I actually got to work with all of these locations that are featured in the book. And I just basically proposed it to them as, you know, we don't really know what the next few months hold in store for you. You know, this is a nice way to get a little bit of advertising. You can sell this book in your gift shop. So it was great to work with these locations all around the country. That was the thing I really wanted to do, was expand from just Western New York, which is so localized and so limiting in your audience, to nationally. All right, let's talk about places in Portland and Florida and Texas and you know, all over the U.S. And it was just fun. I split it up into breweries, distilleries, and wineries, and each location, you learned a little bit about the history. You learned a little bit about either the food or drink that makes it unique and special. It comes with like special tips if you're going to certain locations, or fun facts on the history of it. So it was similar to the Haunted Atlas, where it's meant to be used as a travel guide, but much broader in the sense of where in the country we're enjoying these beverages.
So my question to you on this would be, for all of these that you wrote about, did you actually visit them? Did you visit some of them?
So some of them I did get to visit, but this was in the midst of COVID.
Yeah.
So, unfortunately, most of them weren't even open. Luckily, before even writing the book, even years in advance, I was able to visit at least several of them, which was nice. So you kind of already had kind of a working relationship with some of these locations. Mm-hmm. But it's on my spooky bucket list now to get to some of these locations, because the history for some of them are just absolutely fascinating. And some of the drinks sound amazing.
Yeah.
And now that I'm not pregnant, I can enjoy these.
Yes.
So I'm hoping to be able to kind of cross them all off on my bucket list. A couple of them were featured in both the Haunted Breweries, Distilleries, and Wineries, as well as the Harlots and Hauntings book. So they kind of cross-referenced a little bit, which was also nice to kind of dig deeper into some of their histories as well. So
for all the histories that you researched for that book, can you think of one or two that when somebody, or whatever you read, or someone literally described to you regarding some of the hauntings? Because people are thinking to themselves right now, okay, when I go into a distillery, you know, here's the setup, they walk you through like tour style sometimes. Yeah. Sometimes you can walk around on your own. What is one that kind of comes to your mind of interest of a distillery, brewery, or winery where there's actually a haunting that kind of stood out in your mind, like, wow, this is really kind of creepy? Anything come to your mind?
So the first one that popped into my mind was Old Town Pizza and Brewing. That's in Portland, Oregon. And they popped into my mind first because they were one of the most enjoyable places to work with, where they're not just like, yeah, the place is haunted, here's some information on it. But they were like, no, we are haunted. We celebrate the fact that we're haunted. We share our ghost story. We tell her story. We share her name with people. And I just really respected that. So basically Old Town is like basically the oldest neighborhood in Portland. It was the seedy side of town. It was the rough side of the tracks. It's built on top of the Shanghai Tunnel. So that's like another bit of lore that kind of adds to it. But basically it was a former brothel that a woman named Nina, who was an indigenous woman that was sold into the sex industry. Mm-hmm. She was working there. She found a way out by helping bring in some information. And before she could get any information out or escape herself, she was thrown down an elevator shaft.
Ugh.
And that's how she died. She now haunts the area of Old Town Pizza and Brewing. People have seen her. They say she wears a black dress. They smell her perfume. But the place is just, they've just totally embraced the fact that they're a weird building with weird history. They have a beer called Shanghai IPA. So they, you know, talk about that side of the history.
Yeah.
And then they do pizza and beer. So their pizza, they have a ghost pie that is in honor of Nina, and they just share her story. And it's just always such a breath of fresh air, because especially with restaurants and just areas in haunted hospitality in general, it's hit or miss if they want to talk about whether they're haunted or not. So yeah. When they not only talk about it, but they kind of celebrate it with food or drink, I always like that, just because it gets a conversation going. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's that old saying that, you know, someone dies twice, once when their physical body dies, and again, when someone says their name for the last time. So by them sharing Nina's story and kind of immortalizing her with a pizza, which is just weird.
Yeah.
It's a way of, you know, giving her a bit of notoriety in death that obviously she didn't have that in life. So I really liked their approach to their haunting and how they're trying to find unique ways to preserve it, so people still talk about Nina.
Yeah, I like the fact that people are a little bit more open-minded to this. I mean, I haven't met anyone yet that would say, no, I'm not eating there because it's a haunted building and I don't need to have any spooks sit next to me or whatever, or whatever. I met Amanda in Alton, Illinois at the Haunted America Conference. And while I was there, I went to a restaurant that I guess they would, in the older part of town, I guess you want to call it that. It wasn't a big city, or it was a small town, you know, USA kind of thing. But I did have an experience when I walked in. I could feel something was either greeting me or approaching me, because once again, I get a certain sensation that I cannot deny. And my husband, you know, was wondering what was wrong with me because I was futzing with my head. But anyway, long story short, when I am sitting in restaurants or that I don't even know if they are haunted, it's always such a risk for me to ask the person, anyone hanging around here? It's an old building, you know. And some of them are very proud about it. This one, apparently Abe Lincoln, either he was stayed there or he stayed across the way. And this is when he engaged his wife, Mary, and blah, blah, blah. But they're actually okay with it. And then they had a couple apparitions in there that were, you know, messing with their silverware at night and things like that. That to me is interesting and cool. And to celebrate things like that, especially having a pizza either named after you or whatever. I think that, you know, to me, that's not bringing the name down in shame. That's kind of building up the image that this was a human being at one time that went under really, you know, unusual circumstances. So that's interesting. You know, you hear of wineries being haunted all the time too. What do you think? Have you ever really delved into what do you think is the appeal for, or do you think that the land is imprinted with something that that just stays? What are your thoughts on that?
I'm not 100% sure. You know, in the book, the majority, honestly, possibly all of the wineries themselves are housed, either the tasting room or the whole business in general is usually in some sort of historic home. It's strange now that I'm thinking, I'm like, oh my gosh, like they're all in these historic mansions that usually had a very long, colorful history. And I think that that has a huge part in it. A lot of times these mansions or manors were part of a single family, you know, over the generations that they would share this land. And a lot of times these wineries are the first newcomers that are entering the scene. And I think that there's an understanding of there's going to be curiosity and maybe a little bit of mischief and just kind of testing the waters with who are these people. So I think a lot has to do with the location itself. You know, whether or not the process of winemaking could attract or act as some sort of beacon is something else entirely. I don't know much about the winemaking industry. I just, yeah. I drink it.
Yeah, you and me both. Yeah. Yeah.
I drink it. So, but I would say, like, again, the majority of at least the famous wineries that are out there, you know, they were built by interesting characters in history, or they were these big, luscious houses that may have experienced some heartache and some hardship, some tragedies. And that remains, that stays. And it kind of coexists with these wines and these wineries.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was just thinking of a year ago or so, I went to Tennessee and just had to taste test at a few of these moonshine distilleries.
Of course.
And, you know, everyone's always fascinated by the things that we're not supposed to touch. You know, it draws up the interest a little bit more. Now, in these places, of course, they had licenses to be able to do what they were doing, or they were noted for being a certain kind of moonshine distillery or whatever. But, you know, and I have a past with my own grandparents that were moonshiners, and you know, and so it's kind of, to me, I find it to be very fascinating rather than something to be embarrassed about, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And what was going on then, and why they decided to do that, and all this, you know, it's very interesting. Now, you have also, well, several books, but I want to just touch briefly on this Victorian Christmas one that you wrote, because I found that cover to be very interesting. You have really good artwork, Amanda.
Thank
for
you.
Your for your covers, and as people will have noted in the introduction, they will have seen just a smidget of some of these books that she's put out. Talk a little bit about that Victorian Christmas book.
Yeah, so basically it is a collection of 12 ghost stories written from the Victorian and the Edwardian era, and as well as 6 Victorian Christmas recipes that I've tweaked and updated for the 21st century, because there are some things where I'm like, no one wants to put that in their mouth.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, we're going to change that a little bit. But we have, you know, figgy pudding, obviously, you know, hot rum punch. But then we have mock turtle soup, which is a family favorite now. Like, my whole family is absolutely obsessed with it. So it's all updated, really easy for people to put together. But basically, the reason why I wanted to put this together was, for whatever reason, I've never loved Christmas. Obviously, I'm a Halloween gal. I think most of us are. And after my brother passed away, then I really hated Christmas. You know, the bright lights and everyone's happy, and the, you know, some of the stupid Christmas songs that still make me cry. So it kind of, over the last few years, I've really started to embrace the Victorians' tradition of telling scary stories at Christmas time. Some of them would conduct seances. And, you know, if you think, historically speaking, winter was absolutely terrifying. There was no guarantee that you would survive. It's dark out there. It's freezing cold. It was a scary time of year. Now it's the most wonderful time of the year. Right. I figured, similarly to the Haunted Atlas, where it's like, I'm not the only person that's lost a loved one and is questioning life after death and all that fun stuff. Same thing with the Victorian Christmas book. I can't be the only one that's lost a loved one. And now the holidays are really difficult. It's very hard to be jolly and always happy and going out and buying gifts and the bright lights. So let's offer a substitute for that. So it's a fun little book, gorgeous cover art. Emily Wayland did the cover art for that. And all I told her was, I want it to be red. That's all I told her. And that's what she came up with. It's absolutely stunning. But I just wanted to kind of offer something to people who are similar to me, where we struggle at the holidays. Yeah. We kind of feel like a phony for trying to be happy. Where our ancestors, it was a scary time. And you know, they told ghost stories.
Now let's move into your book. Is it called Harlows and Hauntings? Is that your latest book, or is that
it? It is. So Harlots and Hauntings, I just released at Haunted America. Oh, so it's good. Still, it's a baby still. So, yeah. And it's actually, the breweries and distilleries book is book one in the Spirit Guide series. Okay. And Harlots and Hauntings is book number two. Finally, it took 2 years to get a second book, but
yeah. Tell us a little bit about the contents of that book, because that's a very interesting title.
Yes. So it's just about as seedy as it sounds. So basically, Harlots and Hauntings goes through, it's split into three parts. The first part is the history of sex work that is generally not talked about, because like the moonshiners, well, we don't want to talk about that. That's the dark side of history. Right. Same thing with sex work. It's been around for thousands of years. It's one of the oldest professions out there. And yet we still don't talk about it. Sex is still seen as, ooh, we don't talk about that, but most people do it. Yeah. So it's the history of sex work going back to ancient times, coming up to the Middle Ages, up to the Renaissance, into the Victorian era, and the Wild West era, and then into the 20th century, and then looking into the 21st century to see kind of what's to come. And then the second part is the spirit guide part, where we focus on 11 haunted locations that are open to the public. They're all either hotels, restaurants, bars, cafes, things like that. And we look at the history of the location, the history of sex work in that area, and then we look at the ladies said to be haunting them. And I really wanted to write this book because, especially if you look at the history of prostitution, the women tend to be nameless. If we do know anything, it's usually from the perspective of a man, whether it's a man that was soliciting them for their work, right, or a man trying to regulate and control the industry. So we don't really have a lot of firsthand accounts. And I always talk about how these women were intentionally forgotten. They were made to be forgotten. Yeah. However, there are some that have chosen to haunt where they used to work. And because of that, they're immortal now. Yeah. They found fame and notoriety in the afterlife because these locations choose to share their stories and say their names. Right. So the majority of them, we know their names. We know they're Lydia and Nettie and Eleanor. Some of them, they've just been kind of put to the lady in red, which is unfortunate. We don't have a name for some of them, but for the majority of them, we do. And again, that whole idea of someone dies twice. So let's continue to say these ladies' names so they can continue to have some sense of notoriety in death, which they didn't have in life. And then the third part of the book is just the faces of sex workers, where we look at some of the nameless women, some of the famous women that you might even know some of their names or what they've done or who they were connected to. So it was a very special book for me. I felt like it needed to be shared and talked about. I think it's something that we don't talk about enough. But so many times we visit haunted locations, whether it's a bar or a hotel, and they're like, oh yes, a lady of the night is said to haunt the upper floor. Well, right, what's her name? What's her story? Let's find out. So it was fun to be able to dive into this and really be able to share their stories.
Is there a really sad story that you can recall offhand regarding one of them that kind of went to their demise, and it was really just a sad, you know, thing all around?
So honestly, the majority of them all met very sad and untimely ends. The majority of them, if not all of them, I'm trying to think of one that wasn't murdered or didn't kill themselves.
Yeah.
And they're all very, very sad, which in a way is nice to know that in the afterlife, they're having fun. They're enjoying their time in these locations. The story that really sticks with me, and it's haunted me, but I didn't want to be punny, but it stuck with me, is actually the story of Lydia from the Red Onion Saloon.
Oh.
In Skagway, Alaska.
Yes.
And I think the main reason why I am so connected with this story is while I was interviewing Corey, who is the curator of the brothel museum that's on site, we got an EVP of Lydia's voice in the middle of a conversation just like this. You know, I was on Zoom or Skype or something, and I was going through the recording, editing out my likes and ums because I say them a lot. Uh-huh. And as I was doing it, I heard a voice and I said, that's not my voice. And Corey is talking. What is going on? So I went back and I listened to it, and it's a woman's voice. So that has always really stuck with me. But basically, Lydia, came up to Skagway, Alaska during the Klondike Gold Rush. And she came up with a male relative, but whether it was her brother or cousin, we're not really sure. But he left her in Skagway with some money to survive on her own. And he went up deeper into the gold fields, right. And he never came back. We don't know if he died or if he just kind of started a new life, but she resorted to prostitution. Eventually, she came to work at the Red Onion Saloon, which was actually the nicest dance hall, the nicest saloon, and nicest brothel in town. And she worked there for several months before she contracted syphilis.
Yeah.
Then the madam branded her face, basically to warn people, she's sick, don't sleep with her. Right. And she ended up hanging herself. And she said to haunt this brothel, despite the fact that her life was so tragic with just bad things happening one after another and absolutely nothing to do with any of her decisions or what she did herself. It was just a series of unfortunate events of sorts. Wow. You know, now that she haunts, they say that she is having the time of her afterlife, I guess. Mm-hmm. Again, funny. I don't like it.
Yeah.
You know, she enjoys people talking about her. She loves when people say her name. If you come into the brothel and you don't say good morning to her, she causes mischief. Oh. So that was a story that just has really stuck with me. And I mean, I hadn't heard of the Red Onion Saloon until, I mean, now I've known about it for years, but it wasn't one of those like big places that you grow up hearing about, oh, Gettysburg, right. And, you know, the Lemp Mansion, these places, right. That are like, they're on TV all the time. All so the time. You hear about them.
Yeah.
But this one has just, I have to get to the Red Onion Saloon before it's my time to go, because that's just a place that has really stuck with me. And the story of Lydia has just, it's made an impact on me. And I don't know why, because I research so many women's stories in so many locations. But for some reason, Lydia and the Red Onion Saloon is just, it has a special place in my heart. And I don't know why.
When you researched this out, though, did anyone ever say that she shows herself or her apparition of herself visually, or is it just things being moved or things being broken or whatever that is being caused?
So at least from what I learned from talking with Corey, that it's a little bit of both. Mm-hmm. She does like to move things. She likes to hide things on people.
Yeah.
But then there are reports of people seeing her in both the brothel area as well as down in the bar and restaurant area. Now, I don't know if these are just flashes really quickly, because I've never been able to pin down a description of her. What does, yeah, she look like?
Yeah.
What color is her hair? What color is her dress?
Yeah.
You know, what does she look like? So I'm thinking it's more of a shadow, yeah, or just a flash of something going past someone.
Yeah.
But she has been seen. She's been heard. We've caught EVPs of her, obviously. But she particularly likes to hide things on people and move things around, especially if they haven't talked about her in a little while.
So Amanda, tell everybody a little bit about if they want to reach out to you or the type of things that you can assist with, or just to have people buy your books and all that sort of thing. Give us some information on that so I can get that in the show notes at the end of the show.
Absolutely. So my website is spookeats.com, mm-hmm, which is where we focus on the haunted hospitality end of things. That's where I have upcoming events listed. I have presentations available if anyone is close enough for me to come, or doing, yeah, virtual ones as well. Right. That's also where all of my books are available. My handles on social media are just at spookeats on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, kind of TikTok, not really. I feel like I'm too old for TikTok, but that's fine. I'm way too old for TikTok. And then our all-female paranormal journal, The Feminine Macabre, we're on Facebook and Instagram as well. And then anyone watching who's interested in being part of The Feminine Macabre, we have submission guidelines over on our website. Okay. We are about to release volume 4, and then volume 5 submissions open in October. So anything weird, strange, and unusual, we're always looking for new writers, new fresh meat to write for us. So, but yeah, I'm happy to help anytime with haunted hospitality, suggestions, anything about women's history and the paranormal. Reach out. I'm a millennial, so I'm constantly on social media, and that's the best way to reach out.
Well, real good. Thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for joining us this evening. Dr. Schutz welcomes your emails and paranormal stories. Visit her website at www.paranormaluniversalpress.com for contact information, or go to amazon.com to view her books, searching under Paranormal Encounters. Thanks for listening. Take care. And until next time,
be careful what you wish for.
The script, vocal talent, and music compositions in this podcast program are copyrighted. As a disclaimer, this podcast episode or parts thereof may not be reproduced, reposted, or transmitted in any form without the express permission from the producer and company, Paranormal Universal Press, LLC, or Para-X Radio Network. Any opinion or claim made in any podcast episode by the host or guest does not necessarily represent the viewpoints of Paranormal Universal Press, LLC, Para-X Radio Network, or its sponsors. Properties mentioned in any podcast are publicly known to be haunted or have been discovered to have unexplained occurrences. If you are a ghost seeker, please take precautions and respect people's properties by not trespassing.